It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, the almighty dollar, perhaps a bit too mighty lately. A lump of coal for big coal. And what Ben Bernanke's been up to lately. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 17th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We give you today, as a way to get things macroeconomically going, the American dollar, the global reserve currency, the almost universally accepted store of value. And as of late, the strongest it's been in a very long while. The dollar is almost at parity, 1-to-1. With the euro, it's crazy strong against the pound sterling and the Japanese yen. We're talking 20-year highs here. And there is a temptation, I get it, to say that's great. You want a strong dollar, right? But right about there, market forces rear their sometimes ugly head. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore is on the dollar desk today.
So there are a couple reasons the dollar is so strong right now. First, after years of easy money, the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. Wyn Thin is global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman.
We saw this back post-Great Financial Crisis, and we're seeing this now as we move past the pandemic.
Higher interest rates mean higher returns for investors, and money goes where money grows. So that's been bidding up the price of the dollar. Second, you may have noticed things have hit the fan in a few places around the world, so the U.S. is looking pretty good by comparison. Rajesh Nakati is with BNY Mellon Wealth Management.
There was the Russia-Ukraine war, and then secondly, the zero COVID policy in China.
When freaked out, global investors typically pile their cash into the U.S. for safekeeping, again, bidding up the dollar. So what does that all mean for economies everywhere? Well, for the U.S., there is at least one clear benefit.
It actually helps us with the inflation problem because the stronger the dollar is, the lower import prices are.
Vasily Serebrikov is an FX strategist at UBS. For the rest of the world, it is a real mixed bag. We are buying more of the world's goods, that's nice, but the things the world buys are getting more expensive. Commodities, for example, are priced in dollars. So if you're a country that needs to buy a bunch of oil or nickel or whatever, you're going to have to pay extra to convert your currency into dollars to buy it. Alan Robinson is with RBC Wealth Management.
For the emerging economies that are commodity importers, such as China and India, it's particularly impactful to have a higher dollar price for their commodities that they need to pull in.
These analysts say the dollar is probably going to remain pretty strong for 3 months, maybe to the end of the year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You need a whole lot of dollars to buy coal right now. The per ton price has been rising since Russia invaded Ukraine and since the European sanctions on Russian coal in response. Those sanctions, which were announced last month, take full effect in August, creating, one might imagine, an opportunity for big coal here in the United States. Thing is, though, the big coal just ain't so big anymore. Marketplace's Lily Jamali explains how that's complicating the industry's chance to cash in on this moment.
U.S. coal production is about half what it was when it peaked a decade ago.
A lot of that is driven by the retirements of coal-fired power plants in the United States, which was the major source of demand.
Mark Templeton of the University of Chicago Law School sums up the state of U.S. coal this way.
the industry is clearly in decline and is likely to be in continuing decline.
Some mines, particularly across Appalachia, have shut down. For those still operating, coal executives are passing on making big investments. Flora Champenois is a research analyst at Global Energy Monitor.
The U.S. coal fleet is quite old. It's limping along. It's really lost its power in the market.
All of that has made scaling up right now, when the economics are on the industry's side, tough.
So are you going to hire someone for the next few months? And then the price may fall again. And what will you do with those workers? It's really time to manage a transition. There is no market for coal long term.
That's the case in Europe, too, despite the current surge in demand as Europe moves off Russian coal, says Ian Lang. He directs the Mineral and Energy Economics Program at the Colorado School of Mines.
And so it's not surprising, right, that they would say, I don't think there's a strong buyer here, right?
Maybe a bump for a few months, he says, but hardly a lifeline for an ailing industry. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I guess traders and the algorithms they love decided everything's fine, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Geopolitics of Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine are pretty well hashed over by now. Lots of lies about Nazis in Ukraine, for instance, and Ukraine always having been part of Russia. Left mostly unremarked upon, though, is that Ukraine is a market of 44 million consumers with a fair amount of manufacturing and technology capacity. Its economy has been moving away from Russia toward Europe since the first Russian invasion 8 years ago, and that includes moving in the most fundamental ways. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the phrase you are looking for here is industrial standards.
Here's why industrial standards are important. In 1904, a fire erupted in Baltimore. Firefighters from Washington, D.C. drove there to help put it out. Problem was, their hoses didn't fit Baltimore hydrants.
So these folks traveled to Baltimore to help with the fire, and they couldn't do a thing, at least not with the equipment that they brought.
That's Tim Buta, a professor at the Technical University of Munich. So many parts of the economy need to work together, the way fire hoses and fire hydrants do. Railroad axles and tracks, the voltage coming out of the wall and how much the product you plug in can tolerate, even the threading on nuts and bolts.
Any screw that also requires a nut at the other end, there needs to be a fit between what the threading on the screw is and what the threading on the nut is.
In the U.S., the American National Standards Institute sets those standards, thousands of them. Voltage, that's spelled out by ANSI standard C84.1. Metric machine screws, that's B18.6.3.
Now, in more recent decades, of course, that same issue has arisen on a more global level, right? As we have moved from national to international and by now, for many things, truly global markets.
So the International Standards Organization sets rules to ensure that a product made in one country works in another. Johannes Munoz is a professor at the University of Redlands. He says this is what globalization is all about.
The more of those standards can be harmonized, the easier it is to trade internationally. So standards, harmonized standards in particular, foster competition and allow for more market entry into your local market.
But not every country wants more competition in its local market. Munoz says Russia uses its standards to set up a roadblock for products from other countries.
Everything has to be certified within the Russian system. And that is a quite substantial requirement because their standardization requirements are very far-reaching.
Not only does that keep products from other countries out of Russia,
it's also one way to sort of keep countries locked into its economic orbit.
That's Mark Wu, a law professor at Harvard. Several former Soviet states use Russia's industrial standards. That creates a captive market for Russian goods. Plus, Wu says Russia can dangle its standards in front of less developed economies that want to market for their products.
To say, you know, integrate this way towards us, you're better off doing so. You're going to be more competitive doing so. And we offer a sizable market, right, where you can compete.
In 2015, Russia formed an economic union with other former Soviet states, including Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Armenia.
And then, of course, technical regulations and standards become one of the ways in which those countries, once they become part of this and are tied into that union, then have greater access to the Russian market.
But then there's Ukraine. After Russia invaded the Crimean Peninsula in 2014, Ukraine rejected Russia's industrial standards and opted to use Europe's instead.
Since the war started in 2014, we've really seen a delinkage of the Ukrainian and Russian economies.
Paul Stronsky is a senior fellow with the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says without Ukraine, Russia's economic union hasn't gotten very far.
You know, Ukraine has, you know, traditionally was closely integrated with the Soviet economy and then the Russian economy. The, you know, military industrial complex of the two countries were highly integrated until, you know, just the last decade.
In the meantime, Stronsky says Ukraine has developed its energy and agriculture sectors, its machinery production, its IT sector. And along with Georgia and Moldova, it's been hawking its goods and services in Europe.
The European market is quite large and more robust than the Russian one.
But if Russia is able to conquer Ukraine, it would add another captive market to its economic bloc. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Might not. All right. Probably doesn't. I know. Feel like it. But we are still officially in a public health emergency. Have been, in fact, since late January 2020. As of now, that emergency declaration runs through mid-July. There have been calls for it to be extended, and it looks like it's gonna be. That is according to various people familiar with the matter, as the saying goes. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports on the economics of a public health emergency.
To some extent, the fact that we're still officially in a public health emergency is about sending a message.
There's a certain amount of symbolism attached to the declaration of a public health emergency as sort of a signal to the public that things are still bad.
Larry Levitt is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
But there are also huge implications for the healthcare system and government spending.
For one, vaccines and testing are free because of the public health emergency. Many COVID tests and vaccines for kids are only available as long as there's still an emergency, because they haven't been fully approved yet by the FDA. And as long as it's still in place, states can't drop people from Medicaid.
The results of this have been huge. We estimate that by the end of this federal fiscal year, 22 million more people will be in the Medicaid program.
And then I think there's some really important benefits that I have enjoyed as a provider because it's been convenient for patients, including telehealth services.
Dr. Kavita Patel is a primary care doctor in Washington, D.C. She says the public health emergency has temporarily loosened a lot of the rules that have restricted access to telehealth.
So we have been able to expand telehealth services, being able to give care by video or phone in any geographic area. And that's not something we normally were able to do.
She says a lot of people may not realize it's something they might not be able to keep doing once the public health emergency ends. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Gee, that looks like a serious problem. I hope somebody does something about that.
Yeah, I mean, me too, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 431 points, 1.3%. I did not have the really happy music on my bingo card today. Finished at 32,654. Did the blue chips. S&P 500 added 80 points, 2%, 4,088. The NASDAQ picked up 321, 2.75%. 11,984. As that baby formula shortage drags on, the Biden administration has made a couple of moves to increase supply. Its recent agreement with Abbott Labs to reopen the formula plant in Michigan, whose closure triggered that shortage. Shares in Abbott picked up 4.4% today. The administration also eased restrictions on importing formula. didn't do much to help two overseas manufacturers that said they will be shipping formula to the U.S., though. Reckitt Benckiser fell 0.2%. Nestle slipped almost 0.6% today. A couple of companies gained ground after Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway announced it had added more of their shares to its portfolio. Citigroup, more than 7.5%. The car loan company Ally Financial up 0.6%. Berkshire A shares, by the way. What's your guess? Well, yes. If you guessed $471,670 a piece, you'd be right. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I was in Washington last week, as you know, did a couple of interviews in various official places around town, the White House, the Federal Reserve, and then the last one at an otherwise nondescript townhouse on Capitol Hill.
How are you, sir? Good to see you again.
You remember Ben Bernanke, the guy in charge of the Fed during the financial crisis?
Thanks for taking the time. Well, you look pretty tan, though. You look pretty good. Well rested.
Well, I can jog.
He's sort of retired now, a distinguished fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also, he's writing books, the latest of which is out today. It's called 21st Century Monetary Policy. It's about the recent history of the Federal Reserve.
Well, I've always thought that looking at economic history was the best way to get clues about how to deal with the current situation. When I was Fed chairman dealing with the financial crisis, I tried to use my work that I'd done on the Great Depression about trying to figure out what things to avoid, what to do. And by the same token, you know, there are differences and similarities with the great inflation of the 70s and the current situation. There are also other episodes that probably bear on this current situation. So I think it's important to look back at history.
One of the things that has become clear in talking to Chair Powell and others and you in the past is the difficulty of the decision-making in real time. And you see that a lot in this book. The challenges of reading the signals. And I want you to help us understand how history helps you make those decisions.
Well, sometimes it doesn't. I think that the pandemic, for example, was a pretty unique event, and that reading the signals on the labor market and on inflation have been very difficult for the Fed, because the pandemic has sort of scrambled things in many different ways. But broadly speaking, if you look back at how past chairs, Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker and others approached these problems and what they looked at and how they thought about it, it helps you understand, you know, what the issues are and how to make better policy.
So let's go back actually to the great inflation, the lead up to it. Mm-hmm. Chair Burns and others at that time who didn't get it right. What did they miss that, in retrospect, you as a student of the history of economic policy, what did they miss that they should have seen?
Well, there are a number of things. The first was that the Fed was not as independent as it should have been. Both Arthur Burns and his predecessor, William McChesney Martin, were bullied by the president. And Arthur Burns, in particular, was practically a member of the administration.
The Nixon administration, just to frame it for people.
In the Nixon administration in the 1970s. Many people think that he went easy on monetary policy in 1972 so Nixon could get reelected. The other part of it was, there were several other parts. One was that I think Burns had a rather different view of inflation and the inflation process than we do today. For example, he believed that inflation was caused by what they call cost push, that is, large companies and large unions raising prices and wages because they had that market power and not because of factors on the demand side, things that we look at today. And because of that, and because he felt that the Fed was unable really to conquer those forces, he did not put the Fed in the forefront of attacking inflation. To the contrary, he tried to find alternative approaches like wage price controls, for example. So the Federal Reserve never gained the credibility they would have to have, and which it would later get, to deal with the inflation of the 70s.
I want to dig into credibility a little bit, right? Because for years, the Fed has undershot its inflation target and has been, you know, there have been many slings and arrows cast at the Fed, as you well know. Does that miss, I guess, impact its credibility now? I mean, clearly you believe that the Fed still has credibility, but I guess I wonder why you think that.
Well, to put it in context, the Fed has undershot its 2% inflation target, but usually by just a few tenths of a point. I mean, inflation was around 1.6, 1.7, something like that for a long time. That's quite different from being far from the target. The other problem was that many other central banks faced the same problem, was that after the early 2000s, interest rates generally were very low, and the Fed didn't have much space to cut rates because it hit zero. It was in response to that problem that the Fed changed its framework and adopted this average inflation targeting approach that it put in place in 2020.
Right, which is, to be clear, you know, I'm going to paraphrase here, 2% plus or minus, give or take a little bit.
Well, the idea being that if you can get inflation above 2% for a while, so that on average inflation is at 2, then people will begin to expect inflation to be around 2. And that, in turn, again, will help build the Fed's credibility and help control inflation expectations so the Fed will have less difficulty getting inflation back to the target over time.
Help me understand why inflation expectations matter. You hear that so much now from Fed officials and from economists. Why?
Well, they matter because if people don't expect inflation to return to normal, it affects their behavior. For example, if firms, businesses think inflation, including the costs of their inputs and their workers, are going to continue to rise year after year, they're going to pass that through into price increases and be confident that they can continue to raise prices. And meanwhile, workers, thinking that inflation is going to be high, will say, look, as in the 70s, you know, we need a cost of living adjustment. We need to have an automatic raise. And so that so-called wage price spiral can be self-fulfilling, and it's very hard to break. One of the other differences between the Volcker period and the Great Inflation and now is that inflation expectations in the 70s were all over the place. Nobody really knew what inflation was going to do. They knew it was going to be very volatile, but they didn't have any real confidence. And that, in turn, that made the economy less efficient.
This is perhaps an unanswerable question, but how long do you suppose the Fed has before inflation expectations get out of control?
Well, they're going to have to watch very carefully. I don't have an exact answer for you, but clearly they want to see inflation moving downward at a reasonable pace. One thing that's made their job more difficult is that on top of everything else, we've had recently some big increases in commodity prices, such as oil prices and food prices. And people see gasoline prices and grocery store prices every week.
Every day.
And that is going to, you know, over time, that is going to seep into their views about how they think inflation is going to evolve. So we don't know how much time the Fed has. I mean, I think if we don't see progress, then inflation expectations are going to start to become, as they say, unanchored,
right,
which would create a very strong reaction from the Fed because their credibility is very important to them.
Could you define progress if we don't see some progress in inflation coming down, right?
Right. Well, you know, the Fed's guess, and I think it's a reasonable guess, is that core PCE inflation, which is the inflation rate that they target at 2%, right, which is currently a little over 5, that they'll get that down to around 4 by the end of the year, something like that. And if, in addition to that, we see some stabilization in commodity prices, then inflation will come down over the next 6 to 8 months, not all the way back to target, but in a way that people can see that things are moving in the right direction.
Sorry, random personal interjection. You are retired now, doing whatever you want to do in retirement. How closely do you follow Core PCE and all the twists and turns? Are you still plugged in, or do you go, I don't have to worry about it?
No, I used to joke that one of the advantages of being an ex-chairman is I could read the newspaper and say, gee, that looks like a serious problem. I hope somebody does something about that. So I don't have the responsibility, which is obviously a relief. But I do follow very closely. But obviously, I don't have 300 PhD economists to answer every question I might have in tremendous detail. And so I have to do the best I can on my own.
A little bit more from the former Fed chair on this program tomorrow. This final note on the way out today, I heard Brancaccio say this on the Morning Report this morning, and I figured I would just steal it because it's kind of wild. So you know how Shanghai has been locked down for 7 weeks now, right? Almost nothing happening for most of that nearly 2 months industry and economy-wise, including, said the Shanghai Automobile Sales Trade Association yesterday, zero car sales in April. None in a city of 25 million people. Not a single car sold. All right, we're going, but not without your moment of economic context. And I'm just going to call it right now. This is a timestamp. That whole Elon Musk buying Twitter thing, it's not happening. Definitely not at $54.20 a share. He's just trolling us. Troll, troll, troll. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.